It's lovely to be here. I got the joy of being with my own church this morning and then jump in the car, drive up the motorway and have a meal with Gareth and Lizzie. So this is, for me, it's a fantastic day. The thing I'm loving about New Wine is the chance to see what God is doing in lots of different parts of the country. It's so much fun. Places like this are real signs of hope, where there's a new work of God that's beginning to spring up on the back of, you know, faithful work. You look around, see this amazing building, and you think about what people sacrificed to put this here. And now it's our turn. Yeah, they sacrificed the heating, did they? We'll get to it all in its good time. One of the fun things about being leader of New Wine is that almost every week people follow me on Twitter. And they're nearly always vintners, wine merchants, the occasional brewery, things like that. And every now and then, people that are not to do with alcohol, like follow me on Twitter. And quite often, people then ask me, so what's New Wine then? What's it all about? Like my family hadn't really, you know, been going to New Wine for years, but didn't really have much of a clue as to what it was all about. And my pagan siblings had no idea about what it was all about. So I've had to sort of start explaining to people what New Wine is all about. And the best I can come up with is that we are basically a family of leaders and churches who desire to see our local churches renewed by the power of the Holy Spirit so we can present Jesus as the answer that everybody in the world is looking for. Wow, it's a disembodied voice. This is amazing. The acoustic in here is really interesting. But I mean, that is just that is something that's clarified for us over the last year, because we've had this chance to think about who are we, where are we going, what are we about, and what's come out of that is this great sense that we're a family, that we're committed to each other, we're part of something that really matters, and there's clarity about what it is, because as something becomes successful and it grows, quite often it loses focus. And for many people in the Christian world, New Wine is a summer conference with, you know, great bands and great fun. And it is all that. But all that is for a purpose. And the purpose is that we can see the nation changed. And our belief is that the way the nation gets changed is through local churches. You know, the little thing that you belong to, that you know all of its flaws and faults and the way it struggles and all the things that need to be fixed, like the heating. We know all of that, and yet God says it's through that I'm going to change the world. You know, I love it in Ephesians 1. It says that basically we know what God's plan is. It's to bring everything together under one head, Jesus. And then in chapter 3, it says, and the way that God has made his wisdom known to the powers and principalities is through the church. So whenever Satan looks at God and goes, look at that world, what a mess I've made of that. What are you doing? God goes, look at the church. Now, for me, with my perspective, often that's not very impressive. But from God's perspective, that's awesome. And the world needs hope. The world needs change. And people are crying out for it. And every time they get a vote, they seem to be voting for change. They're basically saying the old ways aren't working. We're going to try anything. We want change. We want to see it happen. We're probably increasingly beginning to believe that actually politically, it doesn't matter what we vote. Politics isn't going to change the world. People are beginning to see that. You know, we do the best we can. We vote with our consciences and with integrity. But at the end of the day, politicians are only human. We also don't believe the world is really going to change by religion. Religion's part of the problem half the time. And so what we're doing here is not religion. What this church is all about, it's not religion. And people outside often will think that. And they'll look at us and they'll go, oh, that's great. You know, a little bit of religion back into the community. That's probably quite a good thing. That's not what we're about. I got a Catholic friend who's got this great story of a Jewish man who moved into a very Catholic neighborhood. And these were all quite traditional Catholics. So what they used to do is they used to keep the Friday fast. You know, I don't know if you know any Catholics, but they don't. You know, traditional Catholics, yeah. So no meat on Fridays, they have fish on Fridays. That's basically, that's the way, you know, because of the crucifixion. So it's a, you know, it had a lot of meaning in the past. That, but these friends befriended their Jewish friend. And the problem was every Friday, he'd be out there barbecuing. So when they're on their, you know, all day meat fast, their Catholic friend would be out there, you know, cooking up some steaks and the fragrance would fill the neighborhood. So they got together and they said, we've got to get this guy converted. It's probably one of the worst reasons for trying to get somebody converted, but, you know, God takes what we offer. And so they started witnessing to him and persuading him and talking to him about, you know, about the church and about what God can do in your life. And after, like, some time, they ground him down. And so there was this great day when these Catholic friends marched their Jewish friend with them. And they went down to the priest, and the priest had this very impressive ceremony. And in the ceremony, he got out the holy water and he would splash their Jewish friend with water. And he said, "Born a Jew, raised a Jew, now a Catholic." And they all rejoiced. He'd joined the church. And until next Friday. Next Friday, they'd explained all this stuff about, you know, what it meant to be a Catholic and to follow that religion. And next Friday, again, the fragrance of cooking meat filled the community. And they're thinking, "Oh, he's forgotten. We need to go around and tell him." So they, like, leg it round. And as they get close to him, they can see him over the fence. He's barbecuing steaks. But this time, he's got some water. And he's splashing the water onto the steaks. And he's saying, "Born a cow, raised a cow, now a fish." And I'd love that story because it's about the foolishness of thinking that you can actually change something from the outside. Now, you know, religion has its place, and sign and symbol and sacrament, they're all powerful because of the inner spiritual realities that they witness to. But actually, it's that reality that we seek. What we're really looking for is we're looking for the presence of God. We're here to meet with Jesus. We've worshipped and we've given him our attention because the reality is, the rest of our lives and most of our week, we're not God conscious. You know, our eyes are not open to his glory. And so we need these times where we come and we focus and we feast on his presence. And that's why a hymn sandwich sometimes doesn't do it. And we want this longer time when we can sensitize ourselves again to his spirit. We say, "Lord, I'm here for you. I'm giving you time." You know, it's great if, you know, if you're married, if every now and then you say you love your partner. It's even better if you actually spend some serious time together sometimes. You know, we need that quality time. We need that date night. We need that focus, that dedicated time where this is all for us. This is all about this relationship. And that's what actually we're seeking. The thing that changes the world is a relationship with Jesus. God's bringing everything together under one head, even Jesus. And the Bible actually does tell us what the church should be like. Now, most of the Bible is actually written to the church that isn't what it should be. But we do get a little glimpse of the church in the book of Revelation. And that's the church in heaven. You know, when the church gets to heaven, there will be heating. There will be everything that the church is meant to be will be expressed fully. And if you know the book of Revelation, you know it gets very complicated, but the beginning bit's quite easy. So I love the beginning bit. And it talks about how John the Apostle is in prison towards the end of his life, and he has a vision of Jesus. He meets the risen Jesus. And Jesus begins to describe the state of all the churches in that region. And most of them have something that he commends and something that he challenges and then a little promise at the end. And those are the chapters that we tend to look at. And then in chapter 4, an angel says, "Now come up higher and I'll show you what's really going on." And John steps out of this world into God's reality. And he sees the church at worship in heaven. Now, that's basically the perfected church. The church that is what it should be. And chapter 4 is pretty much what any religion would say about God. It's full of glory, it's full of angels, it's full of power, it's full of light. Everybody's falling over and bowing down. And it's just, you know, it's everything you would expect. But chapter 5 is where you start to see the distinctively Christian church. And no other religion has got anything like Revelation chapter 5. So I just wanted to look at it a little bit tonight with you. So that we could just remind ourselves of what the church is in glory and what we're beginning to anticipate and work towards here upon the earth. So it begins, "Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with 7 seals. Basically, what he sees in heaven is a book. And he sees a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who's worthy to break the seals and open the scroll. Now, have you ever wondered what's actually in the book? This is the time of year when you're getting your Christmas list together, and most of us are beginning to do the shopping, and quite a few people probably have quite a few books on their Christmas list. Most of the bestsellers are mystery books. At the moment, if you actually look into Amazon and you look at what's at the top of the charts, they're all mysteries. This book is a mystery book as well. It says a little bit later in Revelation that this book basically contains within it the mystery of God. Now, that's pretty one-upmanship, isn't it? You know, not the mystery of the girl with a dragon tattoo or anything like that. This is the mystery of God. And what it does is it says what God is doing in the world. It talks about his will, his purpose, his plan. And it says this is what is really going on. This is what is really happening. But unfortunately, there's nobody who can open it. Nobody in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. And John the Apostle says, I wept and I wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or even to look inside. And then what happens after that basically tells us something really special about the church. And this is what Christian worship is meant to be. The first thing is, one of the elders said to me, do not weep. See, Christian worship comforts us. Christian worship basically says to us, it's all right. You know, no matter what's going on in your life, no matter how difficult it is or how painful it is, or no matter how aware you are of your lack or what's wrong in the world, when you worship, you come out with that sense of, it's all right. It's all right. It may not be all right yet, but it's all right ultimately. God's in charge. God's got it in hand. I've been spending some time this week with the people who just finished our Alpha course, and I love their stories. I mean, it's really exciting. They always talk about how, you know, oh, I'm so excited about Alpha, but then I come into church and I'm loving it, but I just find myself sitting there and crying during the worship. You ever heard that? Just sit there crying during the worship. It's not because it's really bad. I hear it all the time. It's the presence of God. It's the presence of God. I used to, when I first started going to New Wine, before our church started getting to the stage where I was really able to meet God in a deep, profound way every week, I used to go to New Wine. I used to be choked up for the first 2 or 3 days. I just couldn't join in. Because the presence of God that was there was something that I encountered so rarely. And so, I had to move through something. Now, why would you cry in worship? Well, it's basically because God's comforting you and he's healing the hurts. And what most of us have in our lives is we just have nowhere to take it, so we push it down. You know, you suck it up, you carry on. And when you come into God's presence, God says, let me have that. Let me lift that out of you. See, Christian worship is when our Father draws close to us and he throws his arms around us and he loves us and he begins to heal us. And all the hard things fall away and all the pains begin to get met in wonderful love. See, Christian worship comforts. The second thing is Christian worship confronts. It says, see, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. This is basically, you know, Heaven's Worship Volume 1, which is where that song first came from. The Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed, and he is able to open the scroll and its 7 seals. You know, specific, it's Jesus. It's the Lion of the tribe of Judah. You know, our God is a specific individual. He lived in human history 2,000 years ago, 2,000 miles away, in a particular place. He was the man, Christ Jesus. That's our God. Very, very specific. It's not a picture that they were unfamiliar with, actually. They would have seen in many representations of the Roman emperor, they would have seen the emperor standing in the middle and a bunch of people gathered around him. And yet, what they said here is that it's the crucified Jewish rabbi. He's the one who is worthy of all worship, because he's the one in whom God is really at work. He's not going to change the world through princes and powers. He's going to change the world through a suffering servant. You know, our worship, it's not about Jesus. It's not about anything. It's about him. It's about that man who lived and died. It's his life that reveals God, and it's his life which we're choosing to imitate. You know, he should be our study. The gospel should be the bit of the Bible that we feel most obsessed with, most comfortable in, most challenged by, because Jesus is the center of everything. Jesus Christ is true theology. He tells you everything you need to know about God. And he's true anthropology. He tells you everything you need to know about us, about what we can be and should be. So Christian worship is centered on Jesus. And he's standing at the center of the throne, and he's encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. It's actually kind of interesting, because what John is being shown here is that at the heart of it all is not power, but love. You know, there's weakness here, a lamb who had been slain. It's just totally different from the message you hear in the world all the time. And that's, for that reason, the people that are gathered around are not the people you'd expect. You know, the images they would have seen regularly, the mosaics and the reliefs that were carved into the statues, would have had the emperor at the center. And then around him would have been his favorites, powerful senators, generals. And yet here, they're the elders, the people that were unknown to the rulers and the powers and the authorities, the people who had no names or no power, no influence. They just were responsible in the kingdom of God. You know, it's fantastic. It's people like you and me who are basically gathered round the throne. Not powerful senators, not victorious generals, but people who are focused on Jesus, seeking their God. This lamb then describes him, and he takes the scroll, and the church assembled in heaven falls down and worships him. And they then sing a new song. And they sing, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation." Now, there's a lot in there. Again, it's worship to Jesus. You know, worship comforts us, it confronts the powers, it's centered on Jesus, but also it confirms our identity. It tells us who we are. It says, with his blood, he purchased people for God. You actually belong to God. You're not your own. You were bought with a price. That's our true identity. Now, we spend all of our time, or much of our time in this life, trying to establish our identity based on who we are in relationship to other people, or based on who we are in relationship to the power structure within our business, or based on the things that other people could look at and point to show that we're successful, the houses we have and the cars we drive and the things we do. You know, we often try and establish our identity, but there's an identity that supersedes everything else. If you belong to God and you know that you're his son or daughter, that's all that really matters. Because that's all ultimately all we really are. And actually, ultimately, there's no greater dignity we could have than that identity, to find ourselves in him. You know, because that is going to last forever. That's never going to change. Everything else in life is going to change. But our God is eternal, and once he's taken us for his own, then nobody can ever snatch us out of his hand. That's who we are. That is the ground of our hope. We're forgiven, purchased by his blood, all of our sins washed away. We belong together, and we belong to him. And the last thing it says here about Christian worship is that it doesn't end there. You know, worship sometimes we think is just something we do. It's a time we give, and at the end of it, well, you know, we finish the worship now, and we move on to the boring bit, the talk, and then afterwards there's coffee coming, and we thaw out. But it's not like that at all. Because worship has an implication. Worship commissions us. See, we've been purchased, and he says, "You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." Basically, if you are a worshiper of Jesus, then you have kingly authority and a priestly responsibility. God has made us to be a kingdom and priest to serve our God. You're caught up in his purposes. Just by worshipping, you've declared yourself to be part of the new thing he's doing on the earth. And the reason you're still here on the earth, by the way, is to do it. You know, I mean, I always used to think, actually, that it was a bit mean of God that once we get saved, we have to stay here and wait until we can enjoy it. And I know you get some of it now, but I have an American friend who used to say, the best thing you can do for Christians is baptize them, then shoot them. So I think it's quite nice, you know. So, because basically, you get baptized, get them solid in their faith, send them to heaven. Much nicer. It's very similar to what Paul says in Philippians, where he says, you know, far better for me to depart to be with the Lord, but for your sake I remain. Why are you still here? I mean, once you got saved, wouldn't it be better just go straight to heaven? Begin to enjoy the perfection that you're destined for. The reason you're still here is because once God's got you saved, he's got a job for you. He loves to show his wisdom to the powers and principalities through his church. And he wants the people that he saves, who he's purchased and made his own, he wants them to be a kingdom of priests. He wants them to carry authority and to begin to speak prophetically and with power into situations that are broken, bringing healing and hope. And he wants us to be priests, to worship our God in anticipation of that day when all people will worship God. When every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. See, that's what it is. That's what the church is. It's quite exciting, isn't it? Do you belong to that church? Yeah, you do. Doesn't always look like that on a Sunday. You know, in my congregation, we look out and we're just aware of everything that's not quite going right. But actually, we're also aware, after we fix our eyes upon Jesus and we worship, we open the scriptures and we remind ourselves, We kind of look at it and we go, we're part of something bigger. We're part of something bigger. What we've got with the eyes of faith is glorious. And one day it will be revealed for all to see. And what it is, it's all about Jesus. It's not religion, it's relationship. It's not what we do, it's what he has done that we receive and enjoy. So that's what's going on in the world. It's quite exciting, isn't it, really? It's a sign of hope. And what we're called to do, especially as we come up in this Advent season, as we come to celebrate Christmas, is we're called to believe, live out, and proclaim that that is the answer. Not politicians or economists, not religious figures, but Jesus Christ, an obscure Galilean rabbi who died in suffering pain, but was gloriously raised from the dead. And those who put their faith in him are never the same again, because they're changed from the inside out. There's an eternal hope in them that can't be snuffed out. And although it's small beginnings, the Bible loves small beginnings. You know, it talks about us like salt. You don't use much salt, do you? Just a few little grains. The Bible talks about us like yeast. You don't need much, you just need to work it all through. It talks about us like little seeds. They're not very big. If you look after them, they can become massive. See, this is the beginning. This is the beginning of a revolution. It's a little conspiracy. The world doesn't see it yet. One day it's going to change absolutely everything. All we need is Jesus. More of Jesus. So that's what we're going to pray for. Does that sound good?